Young Mexican males coming to the country trying to avoid the Border Patrol in order to work in the United States. And that population, that flow, began to change more than 5 years ago to more and more Central Americans, more and more families, to the point that for the last several years, Central Americans have far outnumbered young Mexican males. Those Central Americans are coming for protection. They're looking for asylum, and they want to be found by the Border Patrol so that they can file an application. Mm-hmm. When they are found, they're placed in Border Patrol facilities, which are just like police stations. They are set up for overnight turnaround of people that traditionally had been able to be returned to Mexico. But under these circumstances, it's an entirely different process, an entirely different population. And the government agencies involved and responsible have not adjusted their procedures, and more importantly, in the case of these humanitarian conditions, their facilities to respond to the change in the population.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we spoke with the head of the National Border Patrol Council president on this program yesterday, and he said it's not their fault. The issue has been about funding. Let's listen.
We only have a finite amount of money that Congress appropriates to us for these facilities. I mean, when you look at this issue, this falls directly on Congress's lap. Congress is the body that determines the facilities that we have.
I mean, do you agree?
Well, certainly Congress is the body that appropriates the money, but at the same time, the executive branch has the responsibility for making requests and outlining its issues to the Congress. The Congress has not always been responsive, because there's been, in the case of these new flows, because there's been a real dispute between the administration and the Congress about asylum and asylum processing. But at the same time, this is not just an issue that has appeared in the last 2 or 3 months. This is an issue that's been developing for years. Central Americans have outnumbered and been the largest population for at least 3 or 4 years. And the procedures at the border and the requests that are made for resources have not adjusted in response to that.
So President Trump did sign a $4.6 billion aid package this week that's supposed to go toward migrant care. But I want to get into that issue of asylum, because this is really at the core of this debate. President Trump and others have suggested that America can't be everyone's solution to every problem. I mean, in particular, when you're thinking about asylum or the issue of domestic violence, if a woman is abused in her home in El Salvador, should she and all those like her be granted asylum in the U.S.? What do you say to that?
They would not all be granted asylum in the U.S., and it's absolutely true that asylum is not the answer for the pervasive problems that exist in Central American countries. At the same time, many people who are coming have connections in the United States, and they have a right to apply for asylum, and the asylum system is not at the present time set up to make decisions in a timely manner in order to respond to those requests. That needs to change.
Doris Meissner, former head of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Services, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Boris Johnson is the favorite to become the United Kingdom's next prime minister. If Johnson wins a leadership contest later this month, he will inherit Brexit. That's the issue that ended the careers of the two previous prime ministers. NPR's London correspondent Frank Langfitt has this profile of Britain's most colorful and confounding politician.
There are many Boris Johnsons. There's the public booster who slyly plays the buffoon, as he did as mayor of London, riding backwards on a zip line, waving a pair of Union Jacks to promote the 2012 London Olympics, only to be stranded 15 feet off the ground, the harness chafing against his groin.
Get me a ladder.
There's Johnson the philanderer, who's gone through two marriages. Now 55, the former UK foreign secretary recently had a row with his 31-year-old girlfriend that resulted in a visit from police.
On the front page of every major newspaper, reports of a domestic between Boris and his partner.
But there's also Johnson, the feel-good politician, who can inspire, as he did at the Conservative Party's convention last year.
If I have a function here today, it is to try, with all humility, to put some lead into the collective pencil to stop what seems to me to be a ridiculous seeping away of our self-belief, and to invite you to feel a realistic and justified confidence in what we can do.
This month, Conservative Party members will vote for a new leader to replace Prime Minister Theresa May, who's stepping down. Johnson faces the current Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, the acknowledged underdog. Nicholas Allen teaches politics at Royal Holloway, University of London. He says, like President Trump, Johnson has a special connection with grassroots party members, which helps make him such a favorite.
Lots of people are just awed by his charisma. They know that he's problematic. They know that he's a flawed character. And they do not care. If anything, they love him more for it.
Johnson has promised to take the United Kingdom out of the EU, do or die. That pledge resonates with many disillusioned Brexit voters who are angry that 3 years on, the UK still hasn't left. Voters like John Mayes, who drives a taxi in London.
Well, I think he's the only person that's going to get us out of Europe. He's committed to it. If he doesn't achieve it in the 31st of October, he's doomed.
Many who've dealt with Johnson find him charming. Richard Ratcliffe, an accountant, met Johnson several times when Johnson served as Foreign Secretary.
He does inspire people, genuinely. He was quite kind, personally.
ratcliffe was seeking Johnson's help to free his wife, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. She's a British-Iranian dual national who's been jailed in Iran on spying charges, which she denies. But Johnson, who's not known as a detail guy, made the situation worse when he told a parliamentary committee she'd been teaching journalism in Iran, which her husband says is false. Iranian state TV seized on Johnson's statement as evidence Zaghari Ratcliffe was indeed a spy. Johnson later apologized. Again, Richard Ratcliffe.
Do I mind him winging things? I think there are consequences for it. You know, one of the things they often say with foreign secretaries is they're either dull or they're dangerous. And he wasn't dull.
Ratcliffe is reluctant to be too critical of Johnson, whose office did not respond to a request to speak with NPR. Others who know Johnson better are less reticent.
I'm quite frightened about him becoming prime minister. He has a very, very long track record of lying.
This is Sonia Purnell, author of Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. Purnell worked with Johnson when they were both journalists with London's Daily Telegraph, based in Brussels in the 1990s. That was after the Times of London had fired Johnson for making up a quote from his own godfather, and before Johnson became a politician and the Conservative Party sacked him from leadership for lying about an affair. In fact, Purnell doubts that Johnson, despite all he says, ever really believed in Brexit.
When I worked with him in the 1990s, he was writing excoriating copy about the European Union. But in private, you know, over a coffee or something, he would talk about the EU affectionately, sympathetically. And I think deep down, he's a Remainer.
Days before going public in favor of Brexit in 2016, Johnson wrote a secret opinion piece supporting staying in the European Union.
Career comes first, always, with Boris Johnson. And he could see that we had a Remain Prime Minister. We had David Cameron. There was only a market opportunity for a Leave Prime Minister.
Now, says Purnell, Johnson could face the hugely difficult task of executing a policy that he may never have really believed in the first place. Frank Langford, NPR News, London.
And later today on All Things Considered, Iran is being accused of getting around export sanctions on its oil by turning off the satellite tracking devices on its tankers. To listen, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or just ask for your local member station by name. This is NPR News.
19 past 8 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. In about 20 minutes, NPR's Noel King talks with Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton of Washington, D.C. about President Donald Trump's 4th of July celebration in the city and the complications involved.
Making it work in this economy right now means working multiple jobs. Teachers, in this case.
I have to have a second job to help support myself.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. When summer vacation means another job, we'll have that story for you all the rest of the day's business news. Not the numbers from Wall Street, though. Wall Street's closed for the 4th of July. Next time on Marketplace.
Your Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from 54,000 individuals and families in Wisconsin and beyond. Their investment in Wisconsin Public Radio enhances and extends the breadth and quality of programming available to everyone who listens. Thank you.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
WPR weather, some patchy morning fog, then partly to mostly cloudy skies with a good chance of rain and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening, and some of the storms could be heavy at times. We're expecting highs in the mid to upper 80s. Friday, mostly cloudy with more rain and thunderstorms likely, and again, there's a possibility that some of the storms could be severe, highs in the 80s. A chance of morning rain on Saturday, then decreasing clouds, highs from the upper 70s to mid 80s, and mostly sunny for Sunday with highs in the mid 70s to mid 80s.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to ensure that families and communities have opportunities to create a brighter future for America's youth. More information is available at aecf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Life is getting harder and harder in the Gaza Strip. Public services are crumbling. The economy is in collapse. Most of Gaza is blockaded by Israel and Egypt. But over the last year, Egypt has been giving more Gazans the choice to leave the Strip, and they are. NPR's Daniel Estrin met some of them.
Gaza's main portal to the world is a black iron gate on the Egyptian border. For years, it's been mostly closed. Egypt and Israel impose a blockade to contain Hamas and keep militants from crossing their borders. To offer relief for Gaza's 2 million residents, Egypt opened its border last spring. And since then, tens of thousands of Palestinians, some estimate around 35,000, have left. Men in their 20s wait at the border for Hamas authorities to call their names so they can cross. I meet a 25-year-old with a backpack and a small carry-on suitcase.
I have no opportunity here. I decided to leave Gaza.
Zayd El-Khoury has a typical story. His family's poor. His house was destroyed in an Israeli airstrike during the first of three wars that Hamas and Israel have fought. His dad went broke paying off a loan to rebuild their house. Khoury went to college, got a BA in English and French, and he was sure his language skills would land him a job.
I tried to apply for international organizations here.
One of the many aid organizations trying to help Gaza. But he couldn't find a job because aid groups are scaling back their work here. The U.S. has cut all humanitarian aid to Gaza. When he couldn't find work, Khoury applied for a visa to the U.S.
I would like to travel to America, you know, the land of opportunity.
But his application was rejected, so he plans to fly from Cairo to Abu Dhabi to look for work. His family's at the border to see him off.
As you see, these are my brothers. It's really bad for me to leave them, and also really bad to leave my mother and my father. But it's necessary for me to seek a better future because I didn't find my future here.
Gazans have seen conditions go from bad to worse since Hamas took over in 2007. Hamas refuses to recognize Israel, and Israel considers Hamas a terrorist group and blockades Gaza. More pressure comes from the Palestinian Authority. It wants to regain control, so it's cut money to Gaza. The economy's collapsed. Youth unemployment is above 70%. And there's a humanitarian crisis. Electricity's spotty. Tap water's undrinkable. A recent White House proposal for investment in Gaza still seems like a distant prospect. Many Gazans aren't waiting around.
Four of my nephews have left Gaza over the past year. I have also to admit that my son, he left Gaza to the U.S. I want him to be in the U.S.
Gaza political science professor Mukhaymar Abu Sada.
I can tell you many, many other stories about people I know. Most of them are college graduates, poor, no jobs. You cannot get married. You cannot rent a house. You cannot start a new life here.
Many fly from Egypt to Turkey, where it's easy to get a visa. Then they take boats for Europe. Some have drowned along the way. Abu Sada says some who make it to Europe seek asylum, claiming they were harassed by Hamas. Hamas has arrested critics and beaten protesters in Gaza. Two of his nephews made it to Belgium.
It was a journey of death, so to speak. It took them days and days to get out from Turkey to Greece and from Greece to Belgium, intercepted by border police many times, were returned back, but they kept trying until they got there.
Hamas sees the open border as a positive step for Gaza. Egypt lets only a few hundred Gazans cross a day. Hamas manages a long waiting list. Pay a bribe, and you can get bumped higher up the list.
Hi.
Hi, Daniel.
I visited an English translator waiting months for her turn to leave. Siham Shamallah.
Wow, what a nice place.
Yeah, I'm selling it. I'm leaving.
She's moving to Egypt with her two sons because she's had enough. In late March, she was home when Israeli airstrikes hit a Hamas security building around the corner, retaliation for Palestinian rocket fire.
I'll show you from here. They targeted that building. Six heavy strikes. I really panicked.
She slept in the living room away from the windows for a week. She takes me to her bedroom balcony and points to a building across the street. She was told a Hamas-affiliated group recently moved in there.
2 months ago.
And what did you think when that happened?
I said, it's over. This building is going to be targeted. This is the main thing. I don't want to sleep, and I'm afraid from the bombings and the missiles, whether from the Israelis or from Hamas. I know that I have a nice apartment, and life in Gaza is nice when it's peaceful. But when the escalation comes, I change my mind. I say, no, I want to get the hell out of here.
Gaza's flight includes talented English speakers like her and medical staff. I visited Gaza's main hospital, and doctors are leaving at a time they've been needed most. The World Health Organization says Israeli soldiers shot more than 7,000 Gazans during a year of protests and violence at the Israeli fence. Nurse Mohammed El-Khtati names some surgeons who have left Gaza.
Dr. Khadr Sabra, orthopedic surgeon. Mohammed El-Haddad, general surgery. Mahmoud Abed, orthopedic surgery. Mohammed El-Hajj, cardio surgery.
So that's, you've counted at least four surgeons who left this past year.
We have cardio surgeon, have experience, good experience. When he leave our country, this department was closed.
No heart surgeon?
No heart surgeon, because he left.
Doctors' salaries have plummeted, and many med students are looking for better-paying jobs abroad. Many young people say they'd stay if there were decent work, even with all the other hardships. It hurts to leave their families, their culture, their home. Some who left for Europe have returned. I met one at the border, Khalil Abu Ibrahim. He says he took his wife and kids to Austria, but he couldn't keep up with the cost of living. So they're back in Gaza, and he's finally found a way to make some good money. Using his experience, he collects a fee helping other young Palestinians apply for visas to escape. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Gaza.
This is NPR News.
Becoming an American means reciting a citizenship oath.
I hereby declare
on oath
that I absolutely and entirely renounce.
When they say that you are now an American citizen,
it is a great transformation.
I felt so moved when I was saying the words.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Thoughts on the pledge from new citizens on this July 4th. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and the day's news on All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. National and international news from NPR is next. And in WPR News, a look at how crowded the roads might be over the July 4th holiday and the latest on the Line 3 oil pipeline. Stay tuned.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A federal judge is giving the Trump administration until tomorrow afternoon to clarify its position on the 2020 U.S. Census and a citizenship question it seeks to add. President Trump wants the Departments of Justice and Commerce to find a way for the question to be included despite recent court rulings. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong says some critics see political motivations behind the effort.
They believe that this question could ultimately be used to help politically benefit Republicans and non-Hispanic white people by redrawing political districts after the 2020 census based on the number of U.S. citizens old enough to vote, not on the number of total residents in any given area. That could ultimately benefit Republicans.
Census forms are now being printed without the question as the legal fight continues. Education will be the focus tomorrow in Texas when almost half of the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates will be speaking in Houston. Andrew Schneider with Houston Public Media has a preview.
The National Education Association is hosting the Strong Public Schools Presidential Forum as the centerpiece of its annual assembly. The speakers include former Vice President Joe Biden, as well as Senators Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Elizabeth Warren. The NEA says thousands of teachers, administrators, and parents have submitted questions for the event online.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Wisconsin drivers are likely to be out in large numbers over the holiday weekend. AAA Wisconsin projects 936,000 people will travel at least 50 miles on state roads, with the highest levels of traffic yesterday through Sunday. That would be a 4.5% increase from last year. Analysts say the strong economy has given Wisconsin a tourism boost. That includes the Wisconsin Dells. Leah Hauk is with the area's Visitor and Convention Bureau.
Wisconsin Dells has already seen record-breaking water park attendance already for 2019. So we're projected to, with the hot weather, do very well for summer travel.
Gas prices are also down more than 20 cents from their peak in the spring. The Department of Transportation has suspended most of its highway work for the holiday weekend. Crews have been opening up additional lanes in construction zones to accommodate the traffic. Minnesota utility officials say they won't appeal a ruling that shot down their approval of an environmental impact statement for Enbridge Energy's plan to replace an aging crude oil pipeline. The Star Tribune reports that instead, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission says it will try to fix flaws in its environmental review. The $2.6 billion replacement pipeline would carry Canadian crude from Alberta across northern Minnesota to Enbridge's terminal in Superior, Wisconsin. It would replace the current Line 3, which was built in the 1960s. Environmental and tribal groups say the project risks oil spills in pristine areas of the Mississippi River. The Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled last month that state regulators must conduct a further review because the project's environmental impact statement doesn't address the possibility of an oil spill into the Lake Superior watershed. Four Democratic presidential candidates are planning to attend a town hall event on July 11th in Milwaukee. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, former U.S. Housing Secretary Julian Castro, and former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke are slated to appear at the two-hour event. It's organized by the League of United Latin American Citizens. The town hall comes 2 weeks after a pair of presidential debates saw 20 of the Democratic candidates square off. This is news from WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Little Passports, a monthly subscription service for kids. Each package includes games, souvenirs, and activities from a new country designed to spark curiosity in cultures around the globe at littlepassports.com/radio. And from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. The 4th of July is always a big deal in Washington, D.C. It is the nation's capital, after all. But this year, President Trump says it will be an even bigger deal. He'll give a speech. There will be military flyovers. There will be tanks. Eleanor Holmes Norton represents D.C. in Congress as a delegate, and she is not happy about this. I asked her what she's worried about.
July 4th here in the nation's capital is a hometown affair. What he has done is to politicize the event. Remember, he's already announced that he's running for president, and added to that now to militarizing the event. Nothing could be more incongruous than tanks on the National Mall. The mall is that strip of land that is regarded as the nation's playground. It's where we fly kites. This is very un-American, and it couldn't be in a worse place than on the green space where we gather to have fun.
The symbolism of tanks on the mall or near the mall is obviously very troubling to you. Are there also logistical concerns from the city's point of view about what it might mean to have tanks rumbling through certain areas?
First, we had to scare them off the streets, and we did that simply by pointing out what tanks would do to Pennsylvania Avenue and who would pay for it. I haven't figured out a way where the heavy military equipment can sit on the grass and not harm the grass. We spent a considerable amount of funds to make sure the mall was fit in a very particular way, so we don't even allow many events to be held on the mall any longer because of the grass. Imagine what military materiel will do.
The Washington Post reported that the National Park Service is diverting about $2.5 million to cover some of the costs of this event. Do you think there will be questions in Congress raised about how that money is being spent, whether that money is being spent in the right way?
I'm already proffered a question to the appropriators about whether or not the president had the authority to divert funds from our national parks to this event. The District of Columbia is owed more than $7 million for the inauguration. Remember, we in the city provide lots of what is necessary, including police and security, along with federal officials. We haven't been paid for that from the inauguration. Now here comes another event, and there has been no estimate of what the cost of that event will be or who will pay for it. I can tell you this much. I'm going to see to it that the District of Columbia does not pay for it and that we get paid for what we already owed.
Let's say Congress determines that national park money should not be spent on this 4th of July event, which is happening. It's going ahead. It is happening. Do you expect that you'd get paid back from someone?
Who would pay for it at the moment are the American taxpayers. Who should pay for it is the Trump campaign, because what it amounts to is a campaign event. There is no way to get around that. And that's why a president has to be very careful of not involving himself in the 4th of July, because everything he does is inherently political.
What are you hearing from people who live in Washington, D.C., from your constituents? Are they happy about this, unhappy about this?
Very concerned. I think the best thing residents can do is to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to march in the Palisades Parade, a neighborhood parade in D.C., but I'm afraid some will feel, since this has the appearance of a campaign event, that they can go and protest. So there is no question that if you make it look like a campaign event, it's going to be treated like a campaign event.
Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, thank you so much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure.
Alzheimer's disease starts to change the brain long before any symptoms appear. So scientists are developing tests to actually detect these changes. And the tests are making diagnoses more accurate and drug treatments more effective. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
The tests are known as biomarkers, and the first one hit the market in 2012. It's a dye called Amyvid that reveals clumps of a protein called amyloid. These amyloid plaques are a hallmark of Alzheimer's, and Dr. Howard Fillett says before Amyvid came along, diagnosing the disease involved a lot of guesswork.
So this test, which I can now send a patient down the block to the radiology office, and within 24 hours, with 98% certainty, I can tell people if they have Alzheimer's disease. And so that's a biomarker.
The test is expensive, though, and requires a brain scan. Also, amyloid plaques are just one of the brain changes associated with Alzheimer's. So the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation, where Phillitt is chief science officer, has launched an effort to speed up the development of biomarkers for other brain changes. Phillitt says one promising marker reveals the presence of toxic proteins known as tangles.
The tangles represent the dying neurons, and the main component of the tangles is this molecule called tau.
Brain imaging can show tau tangles in patients who've been injected with a special dye. And several drug companies are competing to get a version of the dye approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Phillitt says an approved test for tau would make it easier to evaluate new Alzheimer's drugs.
This tau imaging is going to be very important, not only diagnostically, but also for use in clinical trials as a biomarker for monitoring the efficacy of many drugs.
But there's more to Alzheimer's than amyloid and tau. Phillitt says people can have both and still do pretty well until something else shows up in the brain. Inflammation.
It's like having the highest sensitivity computer up there and throwing coffee on it.
So researchers are working on biomarkers for inflammation. And Phillitt says there's even a biomarker that indicates the health of synapses, the connections between brain cells.
We're funding a clinical trial at a company that is going to use this biomarker as a measure of how well their drug is preserving synapses in the hippocampus of people with Alzheimer's disease.
Most biomarkers still require people to receive brain scans costing thousands of dollars. But Phillitt says future tests are likely to use a sample of spinal fluid or blood and cost far less. Maria Carrillo is chief science officer at the Alzheimer's Association, which is a recent NPR sponsor. She says all of the new biomarkers will have to be tried in different populations.
What may represent as a biomarker in one population may not actually hold true in another. And we've seen this in other diseases.
Also, biomarkers still don't offer doctors a reliable way to assess a person's memory or thinking. Even so, Carrillo says the tests have the potential to make Alzheimer's more like other diseases.
We don't treat today, a heart attack after it happens. We treat high cholesterol to reduce the risk of that heart attack.
Because cholesterol is a biomarker for heart disease. And Carrillo says someday doctors may be able to detect and treat high amyloid or tau or inflammation in the brain.
For the future, we hope that we might be able to use these biomarkers in order to stop or delay the memory changes from ever happening. Our goal is to prevent dementia.
In other words, stop Alzheimer's before it starts. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42 now. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. In about 9 minutes, NPR's Noel King talks with actor David Harbour of the show Stranger Things, the show now returning for its third season on Netflix.
Member support is the single largest source of funding for WPR. Thank you to our 54,000 members.
Thanks.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Content that informs, inspires, and engages people all over Wisconsin and even beyond. You make it possible. Thank you for your support of WPR and for making a difference in Wisconsin.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Yoga in the Park will be held Mondays from June 10th through August 5th from 5:30 to 6:30 at Pets Park in Kenosha at Area Number 4. All levels are welcome to attend. Please bring your own yoga mat.
.com.
Good morning. It's 8:44 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls, and here are some of the stories that we're following today. A supertanker believed to be breaching European Union sanctions by carrying a shipment of Iranian crude oil to war-ravaged Syria has been detained in Gibraltar. In a statement, authorities on the British overseas territory at the tip of Spain said the port and law enforcement agencies, assisted by the Royal Marines, boarded the Grace One early today. The Justice Department says it's still considering how to include a citizenship question on the 2020 census. The government has already started the process of printing the questionnaire without that question. President Trump insisted Wednesday that he isn't dropping his efforts to ask about citizenship on the nationwide survey. Last week, the Supreme Court blocked the inclusion of the citizenship question, at least temporarily. And a spending bill passed by the U.S. House of Representatives includes $15 million in grant funding for state chronic wasting disease research. We'll hear about the impact of that in Wisconsin and have all the latest news for you in about 15 minutes here on WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, family-owned and operated for 40 years. Since 1979, Tire Rack has been committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and other performance parts. More at TireRack.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root, more information is available at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at RWJF.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Amazon just closed down its food delivery service. It was called Amazon Restaurants. But the tech giant is trying to learn from its mistakes. It's now trying to solve an issue that has perplexed them for years, the so-called last mile delivery. Planet Money's Stacey Vanek Smith and Sally Herships explain.
Compared with the kind of traffic Amazon sees on its main site, Amazon.com, Amazon Restaurants, it was kind of limited.
Never even heard of it.
Well, Stacey, the service was offered in only about 25 cities, and you could only use it if you were a Prime subscriber. Amazon Restaurants worked a lot like other food delivery services. You pull up the site, you type in your zip code, you figure out what you want to eat, and then hopefully, very soon, a delivery person from Amazon's grocery delivery service, Prime Now, would show up with your food.
The service faced all of these problems, and one of the biggest problems was delivery. Sally, you talked to Vishal Agarwal about this delivery problem. He is the CEO of itsacheckmate.com. That is a company that makes software which helps restaurants get orders from services like Seamless and Grubhub.
Amazon, if you look at it very minutely, Amazon doesn't really do the last mile delivery. And food is all about the last mile.
If you order batteries or yoga pants from Amazon, they may be shipped to one of the company's fulfillment centers. But getting your box to the last mile to your address, that represents a giant logistical challenge. Think about it. The United States Postal Service is the only service that does regular daily delivery to every single address in the country. Vishal says the reason other food delivery services, the reason they've been able to succeed at delivery is because they are the opposite of Amazon. They started local.
So you can't launch something on a national scale with food delivery. You have to go city by city to get any good foothold.
Amazon has really been trying to figure out this last mile delivery problem, but it has not been able to crack the code yet.
No, and another problem Amazon restaurants faced, customers. They do not want to pay more than $5 for meal delivery. And keeping delivery costs low is hard enough if you're ordering a book or something non-perishable. But now imagine you are responsible for shipping a juicy, warm cheeseburger, some fries.
This sounds delicious.
Yeah, right? Also have to make sure the fries don't get soggy.
Yeah.
And all of this, the knowledge and the special ability to deliver food and the ability to be able to get it where it needs to go warmly, that is really, really hard to do. And Amazon has shut down other services and canceled other products in the past. There was Endless, a high fashion site that Amazon launched in 2007. Then there were the Dash buttons, physical buttons, and you would push them to automatically reorder fabric softener or dish detergent. They are also gone.
Well, kind of. This is the thing about Amazon, Vishal says. An Amazon fail is not as black and white as it might first seem.
I don't think they fail. I think they learn and they really evolve from there.
The Dash button also still lives on in a way. It has become a virtual button, an app. And that's what Vishal thinks is happening with Amazon restaurants. So if you were paying attention, you'd know that, yes, Amazon closed its restaurant delivery service. But at the same time, it also made this massive investment, $575 million, in this company called Deliveroo. And it delivers food to people in 14 countries. So this does not sound like a failure on the part of Amazon. Instead, maybe we should be calling it more like a recalibration.
Stacey Vanek Smith,
Sally Herships,
NPR News.
And just a note, Amazon is an NPR sponsor.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab. Schwab believes in asking questions and being engaged. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com.
And this is NPR News.
Good morning. It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, about 10 minutes before 9 now. And classical music coming up with Stephanie Elkins just after news at the top of the hour. Some music of Benjamin Franklin. I did not know he wrote music, but we'll find out about that. Also, of course, some John Philip Sousa and George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Music for the 4th of July coming up in just a bit here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Door Dining. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support the arts in our communities. Learn more at wpr.org/events.
In sports, the Cincinnati Reds shut out the Milwaukee Brewers yesterday 3-0. The two teams play a 1 o'clock game today to finish the series. We're expecting partly to mostly cloudy skies today with a good chance of rain and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening, and some storms could be heavy at times, highs in the mid to upper 80s. On Friday, mostly cloudy, more rain and thunderstorms likely. Again, there's a possibility that some of those storms could be severe, highs in the 80s. On Saturday, a chance of morning rain, then decreasing clouds, highs from the upper 70s to mid 80s, and mostly sunny for Sunday, with highs from the mid 70s to the mid 80s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. It's an explosive 4th of July in the little town of Hawkins, Indiana. But I'm not talking about fireworks.
That's puppy. I repeat. This is a code red.
You know what that music means. Mike, 11, and their little gang of brave nerds are back. Stranger Things Season 3 is out today. So a monster from the upside-down dimension is terrorizing the town again, and Police Chief Jim Hopper has his hands full. He has adopted 11. She's now a teenager who not only has superpowers, she also has her first boyfriend.
Hey! Hey! 3-inch minimum. Leave the door open 3 inches. L, open this door.
What's wrong?
Actor David Harbour plays Chief Hopper in the show, and Harbour says saving the world from monsters seems easier than being a dad.
As bad as the superpowers were in season two, the boyfriend is 10 times worse in season three.
Yeah, you mix hormones in and everything. Talk about the upside down, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I wonder, you've been working with these child actors. This is season three now. Mm-hmm. Is it weird watching them grow up? I mean, watching them get tall and skinny and turn into awkward teenagers, not just little kids?
Yeah, I mean, weird is not even the word. It's sort of profound, you know? Mm. I mean, there are, and that I think is one of the most amazing things of the show this season. You watch the kids grow up in real time and you feel the passage of time more strongly than anything you could write or act. When they started, like, I still look at them as, especially, I don't know, I pick on him all the time, but I remember little Finn Wolfhard with his little pudgy face and tiny stature, and now he's like a rock and roll god or something. He's
this
got this
Mike.
Band.
He's tall
yes,
and
this
skinny
is Mike,
and
yes, but he's,
good
he's
haircut.
Got chiseled features, and he's just, like, dreamy. So, yeah, I mean, it's very strange, and, like, I sort of mirror Hopper in a sense, where I started off with them trying to be very separate. You know, even with my work, I just wanted to be apart from them. And then as the show grows and they grow and they become more of who they are, we've gotten closer and closer.
Do you give them advice? Like teenagers
sure,
are...
but they don't listen.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that they're not listening to this. That would be unfair. But I think that as young artists, they're getting so much success. And I really want them to be the next, you know, I want Millie to be the next Meryl Streep. And I want Finn to be the next Daniel Day-Lewis. And I have these desires for them to be the great actors of the next generation. And I feel like that takes work and it takes development and it takes acting classes. Even when you're paid a lot and well-respected for your acting, and even when it's good at a certain level, it still takes development of that tool, of that, you know, toolbox.
Well, we should note that you are like a capital A actor. You've done a lot of stage work. You've played a lot of serious roles. When you were coming up, did you want to be famous or did you just want to be an actor?
Well, I, of course, in the back of my mind, there was a draw to fame.
Yeah.
I looked at the celebrities that I grew up with, you know, Harrison Ford or Gene Hackman and these guys, and I looked at them as a sort of American royalty.
Hmm.
And then as I've progressed along that line, it's become more and more apparent that, you know, I want to be the messy artist that I always dreamed of being when I was a kid.
Do you mean messy with your life? Messy with your work? Like what?
I mean messy with my work.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially as we move forward with these superhero movies and all this sort of zeitgeist of things happening, there's a temptation to be more beautiful and more capable. And I've always been drawn to characters that are less than capable, that make me feel not alone in my weirdness, in the fact that I don't always fit in the fact that I don't always do the right thing in all these sort of ways. That sort of mess I want to bring to the screen so that people can maybe feel deeper empathy for others. We're all a bit of a mess. I mean, we're all kind of chaotically struggling to get through this life in various forms. And there's a lot of joy in that and a lot of sadness and a lot of all kinds of different emotions. So I've always wanted to portray that much more than to be someone who people looked at as perfect.
Well, I'll tell you something. You're doing it really well. There's this moment in season three, Chief Hopper, you know, he's the chief. He's got a daughter now, but he still lives in a cabin in the woods. And then he gets stood up on a dinner date in a fancy restaurant. So I'm watching this last night. I'm going to tell you the truth. I started crying.
Oh,
I
no,
felt
really?
Terrible for him.
Oh, that's amazing.
This poor guy in his fancy, he put on like a Hawaiian print shirt and he's sitting at the restaurant alone. I felt terrible about that, but it sounds like you're saying that's the art right there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, I love that you had that response. That's so generous of you as a human being. I mean, I think one of the most fun things about this season is that, you know, in the first season, we sort of unpacked how he had been a man of justice and he wasn't anymore, and he had to reawaken that. In the second season, we sort of unpacked this fact that he was he had been a father at one point, and he had to unpack that. And so in this season, he kind of chaotically goes about how to become a man again. And one of those things is, yeah, he subconsciously is responding to television like Magnum P.I. I mean, he shaves his beard into a mustache. He buys an 80s-type outfit, and he tries to be like a modern, cool guy. And it doesn't succeed very well, but I like that he's trying. I love that. I think that's very beautiful about him.
I have a question for you. Season one, deep cut. Real fans are going to get it. Do you still want justice for Barb? Because
we're gonna go there. We're gonna go there.
Barb, we should say, for people who have not obsessively watched the show as I have, is the best friend of the character Nancy, a teenage girl whose younger brother is one of the main characters, and Barb goes missing in season one and just meets a terrible fate. And it's all very unfair.
It's so funny. I was just thinking about that the other day. She was such a great character. And I think each season gets better, and especially this season, I think, is so beautiful and epic and profound. And I was like, oh, we can't get any better than this. And the only thing I thought was, I kind of wish Barb was around.
That was the only. It would be better if was here.
Right? She makes everything a little better.
David Harbour plays Police Chief Jim Hopper in Stranger Things. Season 3 starts on Netflix today. David, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. That was great. Appreciate it.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Rachel Martin. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Join us at 3 for more of the day's news on BBC NewsHour, followed by All Things Considered at 4 o'clock. Right now it's a minute before 9. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR is next.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company, committed to helping build a more efficient, economical, and reliable electric system that powers lives today and tomorrow. ATCLLC.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring the nonprofit Sleep in Heavenly Peace. Learn about how they provide bunk beds free of charge to children who have no bed in which to sleep. For more information, visit their booth at this week's market.
You're listening to WGTD HD,